What I actually will do is say how much, when Sonia talked to me originally about this session, one of the first things people thought about in doing this session was, let's compare and contrast research-tested interventions, like those we have in the guide, with what happens in the real world, practice-based kinds of things. And I lamented, as I often do, that these are not necessarily different, but they're actually part of the continuum, and that the community guide actually has an ability to look at both things that come out of research and things that come out of practice. So my presentation is actually meant to be a link between what Dr. Fielding started by talking about the guide and what you'll hear after, which is people talking about their experience. And what I will have in the middle is a plea to be evaluating what we're learning in the real world and the fact that there is actually a place for that in the community guide, especially as we update our reviews. So that's where we'll be heading. And so the disclosures that you see, and of course I have too, no financial, but I am at CDC and I'm not representing CDC. So as I said, I'm going to first very briefly mention the guide. Dr. Fielding has already shown us enough about it. Talk about some of the challenges that we face when we're trying to assess the evidence base. Then, how do we deal with those challenges, or seek at least to deal with them, and then what your roles may be in helping us to build the evidence base. So you've seen here the website, and you've also seen, this is also the copy of the book that we published in 2005, which is now supplanted by the website as a real-time, up-to-date recognition of all of our interventions. If you see the news and announcements area in the middle of the page, the top thing right now is an ability to access our annual report to Congress, and so you are able to get both our report and the U.S. Preventive Services report through that link. And right below it, we also have access to a number of hot-off-the-press success stories about real communities, how they're taking interventions and using them. So that'll be a good place for you to go for some more information. So let me flip over to talking about the guide and how it's intended to be used, because the intended audiences are what drive everything we do. So the community guide is intended to inform decision-making, not mandate what is done, that relates to the second last question we had, but to inform decision-making of a large number of decision-makers around key areas, practice, different initiatives and programs and services, policy, research, what kind of research might be tried to fill in some gaps that we have in our evidence, and also funding for research and programs, so that the NIH or CDC or someone else might have a request for research proposals to fill gaps, or programs to fill in the evidence base, like the community transformation grants are doing now. So what are the challenges we have right now? Things that really limit the usefulness and the relevance of the evidence base, and how can we try to build an evidence base so that we're more than us just howling at the moon and not really having some kind of impact? I'd like to begin by talking about the first challenge, which I have called the push model to dissemination. And many of us who've been involved in practice guidelines for many years, I've been involved since about the 80s, look at the typical model or the typical approach for developing and disseminating evidence-based recommendations, which is basically we, the experts, are going to get together and we're going to look at the evidence and we're going to figure out what's happening. It's typically researchers, and when we're done, we're going to shove that stuff out at you and tell you to use it. And we have many, many years of experience that show that doesn't work very well. And so the way that the community guide deals with this is that we say that if we intend for recommendations to be used, then we need to take those who are users of the recommendation and actively engage them, not just in disseminating the recommendations, but in actually doing the work of looking at the literature and the evidence. And so they need to be part of that entire process. So we use in users, intended users, at all stages of our work. And they help us to prioritize the right questions and the right topics and interventions for review. They help us stay true to questions over the course of a review, because you can get sidetracked by an interesting question rather than something that's most relevant for the field. And they help us consider issues of context and applicability. What are the important settings and situations in which these things could be used? And is there evidence in making sure that we find that? Thinking proactively about how this might be used, what's the interpretability from the front end? And finally, not having dissemination be an afterthought, but thinking about the user audience and trying to plan for how they will use this from the front end of a review. So because of that, what kinds of people do we try to include in our review process? And I've listed a whole group here, which I think you can identify are related to that broad user audience of decision makers that I identified earlier. So how do we involve people in the guide? Well, we have a formal role, and Dr. Fielding pointed out some liaisons. We've had a fourth liaison enter the room, Albert Tarion, at the back from AFTO. So we have 30 federal agency and organizational liaisons who have an official standing with the task force. And it's 30 not because we want to stop at 30, but because we really work with these individuals. This is not somebody's name stamped on a piece of paper. And so we want to have the size of people that we can actively work with on an ongoing basis. So most of the federal agencies are involved on the health side, and all of the U.S. Armed Forces are engaged with us. Professional organizations like ASTO and NACHO and NALBO, DHB, a number of other of these organizations, and then physician, nurse, and public health organizations, of course, including APHA. In addition to the official people, we also have people who participate on individual review teams. So when we actually do the systematic reviews, we pull people in from the field who work in those areas. So our tobacco review team has someone who's doing hands-on tobacco control work in Lincoln, Lancaster, Nebraska. Someone who works with tobacco-free children. When we did our worksite reviews, and actually Robin Soler in the back of the room did these reviews and pulled in a VP from Coca-Cola and union members on the review. So a broad ability to try to bring people in who reflect different perspectives. And I've identified here the roles. They provide input, especially the liaisons, but also the participants in the team, into how we prioritize our topics and reviews. They also talk with the task force as they make recommendations to provide the perspectives on how they're going to be used. And they also participate in dissemination and implementation support specifically for their own constituents. Now I want to move to a second challenge that we face. And that is that community prevention interventions vary very widely in terms of complexity. Some people are just interested in handing out a pamphlet or doing something that's straightforward, like looking at a particular one-on-one education intervention. But sometimes some of these have a secondary component. You rarely do have one-on-one intervention or one-on-one education or group education right now that you don't hand somebody a pamphlet as they walk out of the room. So we need to look at what is that considered a single component? Because if we cut that out, then a lot of the interventions that people do aren't really going to fit because that's something that's normally done. So we try to break apart what we would call a single component intervention from some of the complex interventions where you actually have two or more interventions that are distinct, that are used alongside of each other. And this often happens, or two things, that are not inherently distinct, but that are sitting alongside each other. And so what I use here as an example is two different kinds of group-based education that you might use together. That's different from where interventions are distinct. And that's where we might have multi-component interventions. That often happens in the field where you use a number of things together. And so we try to look at individual components, but then to look at what happens when you use a multi-component approach. In order to address this, we really need to think very carefully about what's the definition of an intervention. And it's really important that people know what it is considered when we talk about small media, for example. When I went and talked to people in congressional staffers about that, they thought it meant PDA-sized material, where we were talking about using print. So we need to look at inclusion and exclusion criteria so that when decision makers look at something, they know what we've considered. And we also need to know how the intervention is expected to influence the intended health outcome. So one of the things we do is develop logic models that really show how we think an intervention can relate to the outcome and the harms and benefits that Dr. Fielding talked about as being very important. So we need to think about the breadth of a review. How wide of a review do we want versus how narrow of a review? When we define an intervention, we want to make sure that it's specific enough that you can use it, not education. We need to break it down so that decision makers can actually get a handle on what we're doing. But if it's too narrow, then it can be very hard for, say, a state-level person to decide whether something works across different settings. So it's trying to find that, that right sweet spot between breadth and narrowness. And we want some variation when we put interventions together, because then we can look at every time you do things in your communities, there are slight variations. And so it allows us to look at how generalizable things are when you adjust things a little. We've heard about that mix of fit and fidelity that many of you have think about. It's also important to think about what are some effect modifiers that are important to consider. These effect modifiers are things like the characteristics of an intervention. How intense does an intervention have to be? Duration. Do you have to do it all at once in an hour, or can it be 5-minute sessions that are stretched out? This is really important in school settings, for example. What kinds of characteristics of the study are important? What about population characteristics? Environment, do things work equally well in urban and rural settings, for example? And what about other things, like if the baseline is low and you're trying to get people in to do an intervention, you might be able to get a lot of people in. But if most of the people are doing it and you're trying to get to some of the at-risk or hard-to-reach populations, is it still as effective for those groups? The challenge for us here is that this information is very rarely reported, and so we really struggle to try to get that information. That relates to a third challenge that we face, and that is we all hear about internal validity, and some of you have just come from another session that we just had where we talked a lot about that. The typical research paradigm starts with thinking about internal validity. When you look at something, are you able to determine that the intervention is effective because you control everything? Well, in real-world settings, rarely are situations controlled. And so decision-makers in our areas want to know, let's say they're at a state level, are the findings generalizable to all of the different groups that I'm responsible for? And at a local level, is this going to work in my specific area, not just in New York City where they have lots of money, for example? So when we look at addressing this challenge, Community Guide always considers external validity, generalizability, and applicability. Will the intervention work in other settings and situations? We look at all of those characteristics that I talked about, and all of those users who sit with us in a review help us figure out which ones are the most important. So the users are important. The challenge again, though, is it is rare that we are able to get the detail of information we want here. That leads to the fourth challenge, and that is randomized controlled trials for many people are considered the gold standard research design. But in many of the areas we work in, population-based, community-based work, they're often not feasible. They may not be ethical. So feasibility, you can't randomize people to be subject to a law or not. Ethical challenges are often there. And thirdly, and really importantly related to our last discussion, is external validity. You might be able to set up a randomized trial, but it's so controlled, you really can't get at the issues of external validity. So what does the Community Guide do in this situation? Well, it makes a judgment call, and it says, study design is one source of variance. Is this source of variance so important that we should single it out from all of the other sources of variance? Or, if we treat study design as different from all of the other potential modifiers of effect, and potentially more important, is that going to outweigh the benefits? And our mission is to provide information that's useful to decision makers, most importantly. So the question we ask ourselves is not, is the study perfect, but does it provide information for us? Is it informative? So we include a wide range of study designs in our reviews, so we can look at generalizability, so that we can increase power, because we're not looking at just one study, and so that we can actually look at the biases as best as we can empirically, or by thinking about sources of bias that might be different across different designs. So we consider these other designs. We look at which designs might be stronger or weaker for a different purpose. How well do they control for external validity as well as this internal validity? And we try to learn across different designs. And that leads to the final challenge that I'll talk to you about, and that is that even though researchers often agree on the intended outcomes of an intervention, such as we need to get obesity rates down, a real challenge is that different people, whether it's in a research setting or in a community, use a different measure of outcome. So some people are going to look at weight. Some people are going to look at BMI. Some people look at skin, trifold skin thickness. There's all of these different measures. Well, we can't pull it all together. And so what that does is cause challenges for us because we have less studies to look at. So what's a challenge there? Well, we do try to look at all of the different outcomes that are there, and we try to look at effectiveness across these as we can, but typically we do that in a qualitative fashion. We're not able to combine the information together. That causes a loss of power, and that is often one of the reasons that we get insufficient evidence to recommend for or against. So how do we put all of this together? Well, just in a schematic to show you all, when we have a conclusion of effectiveness, we look at a number of things. The first thing we look at is a body of evidence. How many studies do we have? What's the quality of those studies? What kinds of limitations are there? And what is the suitability of the study design, including for the question at hand? Then we also look at effectiveness. First, we look at consistency of effect. When you look across all of the different things that we have in front of us, are most of them in the same direction? Are most of them favoring an intervention being effective? Or is it all over the map? And secondly, not just is something statistically significant, but is it really significant and not even clinically significant? Is it really significant in a population health frame? And as I've put in the left-hand corner of the slide, what's really important here is that whether it's a research-tested or a practice-based intervention, it applies the same way, the same questions. So this is a way of showing, again, now in summary, what Dr. Fielding showed earlier about the different things we ask. We don't just look at whether the intervention has intended outcomes and leads to morbidity and mortality, but we look at barriers, we look at economic information, of which there is rarely any. We look at additional outcomes and benefits and harms and applicability. So the task force has a formal review of applicability where that team of users and scientists get together and identify the most important things to look at. And then we bring to the task force what we can learn from the evidence, which is often sorely lacking, what we can learn from theory, what we think might be important, and the areas we really do not have enough information about. And that is put in a rationale statement that accompanies the recommendations. This leads me to just summarize this to say that with all of this work, we consistently come up with three types of research gaps, and these are written about in the annual report to Congress here. And it's important to say that these research gaps are evidence gaps. Evidence gaps can be filled by research studies, but we're never going to have enough money to study all of this using research. We need to learn from what's actually happening in the real world. So the first type of evidence gaps is where there's insufficient evidence, and that's where we address, I think it's Elizabeth Bancroft, did I get the name right?
Yes.
Her question. So the task force findings can be insufficient evidence for a number of reasons. And the reasons can be because there aren't enough studies in the first place, whether it's research or evaluation. It can be because there's too few studies that have those comparable outcome measures that I talked about before, or where the components are so different you can't compare them. Thirdly, you can have evidence from different studies that's really mixed, and you can't really figure out why. You've looked at all of those different things like duration and you still can't figure out why there's differences. Or the studies are just of really poor quality. Or finally, and this is the monetary sanctions thing that Dr. Fielding talked about, we looked at vaccines and there was evidence that sanctions could be helpful in certain populations. But the task force was very concerned about the harms that could do to low-income people, and so they recommended insufficient evidence in that situation. So a second type of research gap is where there's insufficient evidence to know whether interventions that are effective in some populations, settings, and contexts would be effective in others. And the typical things that we have challenges with, in other words, we look at what we have in front of us, whether gray literature, published literature, we do not have enough information for low-income populations in many cases, racial, ethnic, minority populations. We have information about cities often, but not inner city or rural. So lots of suburban or sort of that in between. Interestingly, we have lots for sort of normal adults, but not for older adults, and a lot, not very much for children, and especially not very much for adolescents. So right now with vaccines, when we updated all of our reviews, HPV is on the horizon, and we don't know if we can extrapolate to adolescents, for example. The third type of research gap is that alongside of evidence, we really need information to adequately support practitioners, policymakers, and other decision makers when they're trying to select and implement effective interventions that meet their needs, their preferences, their constraints, and probably most importantly, the amount of money and other resources like staff they have available. And this kind of information is sorely lacking often. So we really can't often find out whether different types of providers are important. The intensity and duration. I talked about a school setting. You go into a school and tell them they need a week at a time, you're not going to be able to use that intervention in that setting. And cost and economic outcomes. And finally, things like interaction when we're looking at multi-component interventions and how-to methods for selecting and implementing recommended programs, services, and policies. They're just starting to be developed in some groups, but we need to pull this together and have it available to other people. So what are your roles? I have two final slides here to give you what you can do in the middle of this. The first thing is consider the value of evaluation of real-world programs, services, and policies as important means of assessing applicability of things that are identified through the evidence and helping us to really understand how it applies to different groups, settings, and situations. And then also identifying and evaluating innovations from practice so that we can start to build that practice-based evidence. And the final two points, there is a plea for you to report enough information about your study or your evaluation so that it can eventually be pulled into evidence synthesis so that we can learn across the work that's going on. So clear definitions of the intervention, clear definitions of information on applicability, whether it's research tested or practice based. And finally, again, a plea for common measures of outcome and groups that actually, funders, for example, or groups of you that work together. Hey, go on and do what you're doing, but if you all had one indicator in common, we might learn a lot more from different groups. And I'll stop there.
Thank you.
To make sure we get everybody in, I will continue and not open up for questions right now. So you've heard about the big picture, and you've seen the challenges that we go through in identifying whether there is sufficient evidence, and we within APHA grapple with that when policies come up. So you might ask, well, does this thing really work, and how does it work? And we're beginning with three case studies to demonstrate where it works and how it works, beginning with Dr. Akhtar. He will tell us what works in Maryland and how it works in Maryland.